Welcome to another edition of Blue Republican Radio for the Liberty Curious. This is me, Robin Kerner, the original Blue Republican. And I'm going to be talking today about a topic that actually I know nothing about. And there's not many things that I would say I know nothing about, but I know nothing about this one. But this is a topic that I know is very dear to the hearts of many, many libertarians, many people who care about personal liberty. And it is also a topic that has kind of really made the headlines end of last year, when Washington and Colorado supposedly, I put that in quotes and we're going to discuss that, legalized marijuana. Now, the gentleman I have on the show today is a Mr. Steve Sarich. I hope I pronounced it. I pronounced that right, Steve, of the Cannabis Action Coalition. Welcome to the show, Steve. It's good to have you on.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, you and I only, you know, we kind of just met on the phone, as it were, less than an hour ago. So I know very little about you, but of course you come highly recommended to me through a mutual friend that we have, who's actually running for state senate, who you've been doing a little bit of work with. So as far as I'm concerned, you come with good pedigree and credentials. But please introduce yourself to the listeners of Blue Republican Radio.
So anyway, I've been doing this for about 12 years. I was born and raised in Seattle, but moved away and lived pretty much all over the place for like 20 years, everywhere from Moscow, Russia, to Honolulu, Hawaii. When I came back here and we had medical marijuana, I got involved with it, but it had problems. And I come from a corporate background, and I'm the former executive vice president of Colt Firearms, so I thought, well, you know, with my background, I ought to be able to solve these problems in a year or two and then move on.
Okay, so now tell...
12 years ago.
Well, so 12 years ago, what made you want to get into this field? Do you have some personal interest, or is there some family member that's got some involvement with medical marijuana?
No, I used medical marijuana before it was medical. I've got degenerative disc disease and a variety of other problems. So I got off prescription opioids probably 20 years ago. By now I would have been dead if I kept taking them.
Okay, really? So this really is a personal thing for you, obviously.
Yeah,
very,
really
very
is.
Closely personal. Okay, so did you found the Cannabis Action Coalition as a means to your end? Okay, and what is the main purpose of your work and your organization?
Well, my job is to protect patient rights. We write legislation, we get candidates elected, or we get them fired. But we deal with law enforcement. We provide free legal assistance to patients, and we have for 12 years. Just about anything a patient needs, we try to help out with. And the majority of the patients in the state of Washington that we represent live on $600 a month or less. So if they get in trouble, if they have problems with law enforcement, we jump in, because they just really have no resources.
Wow.
And public defenders, I think pretty much everywhere, are pretty abysmal when it comes to defending anybody.
Now, but presumably defending medical marijuana, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but defending medical marijuana users 12 years ago when you started, when it had a different, let's say, legal and cultural status, must have been quite a different thing from defending them now.
It's very similar. At the moment, there are fewer drug task force raids than there used to be. That has fallen off a bit since 2012. But prior to 2012, 80% of the civil forfeiture money taken in from that was taken in by drug task forces were coming from medical marijuana patients. And
that's an extraordinary statistic. So you're saying that these people that, you know, these public servants supposedly that we pay to fight drugs, that most of the fight has actually not only been against users of what is broadly a harmless drug, but actually those users and those who supplied those users who need that drug to actually be able to live a comfortable life.
Yes, because it's really about policing for profit.
Wow.
One of the drug task forces that raided me, by the way, I have the unique title of having been raided by more drug task forces than any human being in the history of the state of Washington, though I've never been arrested and I've never been charged or certainly not convicted of any crimes. And
my God.
I've just been robbed at gunpoint numerous times. So I know what they do. And as long as you have a two-channel approach to civil forfeiture, you're going to have this problem. As long as they can come in and rob you at gunpoint and terrorize you and steal everything you own, and there's no ramification for them, this is a wonderful way for them to make money. I know one drug task force, the first one that raided me, in doing our public records request, we found out that they have $1 million Wall Street investment account.
Goodness me.
So that's why we're going to try to change the civil forfeiture laws
Wow.
in the 2015 session of the legislature and take out the profit motive. If they're going after, if 80% of the people that they're going after are medical cannabis patients who are certainly of no danger to society whatsoever,
right.
then they aren't going after people that are selling heroin or crack or whatever else.
Absolutely.
They need to get back to doing their jobs.
Yeah, now just so I'm clear and so my listeners are clear, and I don't know if this changed with the recent legislative changes in Washington State, but when you were being raided before those changes, those legislative changes, were you actually doing something illegally, which in at least in the eyes of the law, legitimized what was being done against you?
Well, here's the way the law was passed, and I think that is now, it's questionable whether or not a recent Supreme Court ruling has clarified that or not, but all we ever had was an affirmative defense. In other words, they could always raid you, arrest you, prosecute you, and all you had was a defense against that prosecution in court, an affirmative defense. So, yeah, they were pretty much free to go ahead and do whatever they wanted to. Whether or not they could get a conviction or not was another story. But they didn't care because all they were doing is robbing.
Okay, but they would say they were enforcing the law as it then was. Would they say that?
Well, that's interesting considering I've never been arrested.
Well, indeed, that is interesting. So we're coming kind of to the end of this first segment. We've got another couple of minutes. But this is a good way in. What changed with the recent, quote, legalization, unquote, of marijuana in Washington State?
Wow, that's a big question. Do you mean what has changed for patients?
First of all, what actually has changed in terms of the law? Like, in theory, what's changed? And then discuss what this means for actual users.
Well, this is why I run the No on I-502 campaign. I was the one who led the charge against the quote-unquote legalization here in Washington, simply because it wasn't legalization. No one wants legalization more than I do, considering my history.
Mm.
I'd like them to stop coming into my home and robbing me at gunpoint.
Sure.
But what we got was not legalization.
So what did we get? Because this is really interesting, because the mainstream media pushed this, as they always do, very crassly as, okay, marijuana's legalized, isn't that great in Washington and Colorado? And a lot of liberty folks around the country thought, you know, big win for liberty. What's the truth?
Well, the truth is, in order to legalize something, you must remove all the laws that are in place that made it illegal in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And I-502 did not remove one law that made marijuana illegal in the state of Washington, and it's still a Schedule I narcotic
Wow.
in the state of Washington. All it did was it made an exemption for 1 ounce of marijuana.
For anybody, right? This is exemption for the possession of 1 ounce of marijuana, possession
correct.
By anybody. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Anybody 21 or over, right?
Okay.
But other than that, it added new laws to the books that we found heinous, like a per se DUID law. And which means now if you are picked up by the cops and they get a warrant to take your blood and you have 5 nanograms per milliliter or more of THC in your system, you're automatically, like at .08 with alcohol, you're automatically guilty of driving impaired. When in fact, you aren't impaired.
Now, okay, so let me just say, this is a chemical that would be in your bloodstream if you had recently smoked marijuana, right?
It stays in your bloodstream, according to the last study from the National Institute on Drug Abuse, can stay in your body. It's stored in the fat cells. It's lipid soluble.
Okay.
So it's stored in your fat cells.
Hold on there, Steve. We're going into the break, so we'll come back and carry on with this when we get
back.
Welcome back to Blue Republican Radio. What an interesting conversation I am having with Steve Sarich here about the non-legalization, let's call it, of marijuana in Washington State. Steve, do you know whether what went on in Colorado was similar to what went on in Washington from a legislative point of view?
Well, yes, I'm pretty familiar with it because activists communicate between the states.
Yeah. Was it the same deal?
The same people sponsored... funded both bills.
Okay, so now
neither bill was funded from inside the state.
Okay, now before we talk about how, you know, what were the interests behind these bills? Let's just talk about what were the interests behind these bills. Who were pushing these bills, and how was it? And did the liberty movement, did people who, let's say, on the one hand, believe in individual liberty, who were supporting this, did they get hoodwinked?
Well, everybody got hoodwinked.
Okay, so who was hoodwinking us and why?
Well, first of all, on the DUID, I'm an expert, probably one of the, if I'm not the number one expert, I'm in the top three of experts on THC and driving impairment. I'm actually certified by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration as a drug recognition expert and in giving the standardized field sobriety test, mm-hmm. which you'd normally take alongside the road if you got pulled over. And what all the studies say, going back 40 years, and studies not from Cheech and Chong or High Times, but studies from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Federal Department of Transportation, National Institute on Drug Abuse, all pot haters, they all say the same thing, that you cannot judge impairment by measuring blood content for any drug besides alcohol. In other words, according to NIDA, latest study from NIDA, which was a year and a half ago, active THC, not metabolites, but active THC can stay in your bloodstream, stored in your body for up to 30 days.
Okay.
And so I guarantee you the joint you smoked 2 weeks ago is not impairing you. I've had my blood tested first thing in the morning by a doctor, and I am generally 4 to 5 times the legal limit to drive when mm-hmm. I wake up in the morning.
Okay.
And I'm sure I am right now. I hope I don't sound too impaired.
But, not at all.
but you can see what the problem is. And on top of that, it added another heinous charge, which is a zero tolerance per se DUID for those under 21. So over 3/4 of our college students, if they have any THC in their system, and again, remember, it stays in your system for up to 30 days. If they have any THC in their system, they will have a permanent driving under the influence of drug charge on the record forever, and they can actually lose a college scholarship. They can actually lose a college funding.
Wow.
So how is that making marijuana legal?
Okay, help me understand. Who benefits from that? I mean, either ideologically or practically.
Well, let's start with where did that come from, per se DUID. It appeared at the last minute in the initiative And it came from the ONDCP, Office of National Drug Control Policy, the drug czar's office. Mm-hmm. And it is their new war on drugs. It's, you can have marijuana, but you better not have it in your system because we're going to charge you with something much greater, something with much greater, okay. That will do you much greater damage than a simple possession charge. So that was the big push. And if you go into the ONDCP website and you look up drugged driving, it explains what they're doing. And so Gil Kerlikowske, who is the drug czar, used to be the chief of police in Seattle. He was good friends with Alison Holcomb, who wrote I-502, and John McKay, the federal prosecutor who supported I-502, was the prosecutor when Kerlikowske was the police chief. All of a sudden, it ends up in this initiative. It didn't end up in the Colorado initiative. It just ended up here. Who benefits from that? Progressive Insurance benefits from that because they write high-risk insurance policies. And they make a lot more money off of high-risk marijuana policies than they do off of high-risk alcohol policies because, in fact, you're not driving impaired. You're not getting in accidents. You won't find reports showing that once marijuana was legalized here or once medical was legalized that you all of a sudden had a rash of fatalities caused by stone drivers. In fact, there was a study done out of Colorado and Montana where they studied the first 9 medical marijuana states. And what was amazing is in every single one of those 9 states, traffic fatalities after medical marijuana passed, so obviously more people were smoking presumably, in all 9 states, traffic fatalities went down an average of 9% to 13%.
Now, hold on. Now, you've mentioned, why did you mention Progressive Insurance? What are they related to the bill?
Peter Lewis of Progressive Insurance was one of the 2 major funders of I-502 and Amendment 64 in Colorado.
So the calculation that you're suggesting here that has been made is that people are going to start to get hit with these charges because they're going to be found driving drugged. And
it's already happening. If it was the measles, you'd call it an epidemic. Since I-502 passed.
Yeah. Okay, so since I-502, have the cops stepped up testing? You know, basically stopping drivers and testing them for this.
Well, they now the only way you can test for active THC is through blood. And
unfortunately,
yes. The Supreme Court came up with a new ruling that said you have to have a warrant for testing blood, but they just get telephone warrants now.
But you're saying this is already happening.
As an expert witness in court, I can beat those all day long, but not everybody's going to have an expert witness in court.
Okay, but are you actually saying that as a result of this law, more Washingtonians are getting caught and prosecuted for, you know, what we know is harmless, but for having something in their blood, whereas before this law they would not have done?
Correct, and you cannot claim that you were not impaired.
Okay.
You can't even make that argument in court. The fact that you have it in your blood is all they need to convict you.
Okay, now, but how does so these insurance policies that are written by Progressive, from which one of the, you know, this law has a major backer, these are policies to cover the legal expenses that would accrue if you were to be caught and prosecuted?
No. The insurance is if you get caught for driving under the influence of marijuana, it's like getting caught for driving under the influence of alcohol. Your insurance rates go sky high.
It's an excuse to raise the rates. That's what we're talking about.
Of course, and with alcohol, that makes some sense because if you're a habitual drunk driver, your chances of getting in a wreck and killing someone are much higher. But of course, they aren't with marijuana.
Now, was this okay? So, what political organizations were supporting this?
The Democratic, the most liberal of the Democrats in the city of Seattle were the ones who were pushing this bill.
Do you actually now? Were they being paid to commercially benefit Progressive or any other company, or did they genuinely believe they were legalizing marijuana?
Well, it's when it. You know, it's always difficult to say. I don't know what if any financial arrangements were made. I do know that the Roger Goodman, Representative Roger Goodman, who runs the DUI work group for the legislature, what they did was they added a new regulation after 502 was passed that says if you get pulled over for a marijuana-related driving crime, within 10 days of your arraignment, you have to put an alcohol interlock device on your car. Well, but he admitted that an alcohol interlock device will not detect THC, but his largest campaign contributor last election was the alcohol interlock industry. So we're just debating now whether or not
this is
driving
insane.
And talking on a cell phone will all of a sudden now require an alcohol device.
All right, Steve, we're going into the break. We're going into the break. This is amazing. We'll be back soon. Welcome back to Blue Republican Radio. This is the long third segment of the show, and right now my head is kind of buzzing. This is blowing my mind at just how corrupt this whole thing, this quote legalization but actually non-legalization of marijuana was. The vested interests, the special interests, it makes me want to jump out of a high window, Steve. Tell me more about it. Like, just carry on.
Well, Representative Goodman, who required alcohol interlock devices, passed another law. Even though Roger, I've known him for 10 years, knows that there is no impairment as such, no level of impairment that you can determine with marijuana. But he decided to pass another new law that said that it was actually an add-on. It was an enhancement. And if you drive with your kids in the car, there's up to a $5,000 additional penalty. More alcohol interlock time, of course, because that supports the people that support him financially. And here's the problem you get into now. Oh, by the way, Roger, there's a website up for Roger. It says Roger Goodman drives stoned, because Roger's wife sued him for divorce last year, accusing him of always going behind the house and smoking a joint before he took the kids anywhere. Now, this is the same person that's passing the law that I'm talking about now. So now, if you are a medical marijuana patient, you have your two kids in the car, and you get pulled over, and they manage to test you and find that you've got 5 nanograms in your system, you now have 3 charges, 4 charges. You have driving under the influence of drugs. You have an enhancement of having your child in the car. So you have 2 of those, okay? And now you get a 3rd charge. Which is reckless endangerment, none of which, if you've lost the first one, you can't win any of them. And you don't just have one attorney, okay, because you have to have a criminal attorney for the DUI, and you have to have a family court attorney because they're going to take away your kids. And you're going to have to try to get back your kids because you were driving impaired with your kids in the car, and you couldn't beat that charge.
Steve, this
you're looking at about $40,000 in legal fees. And again, as I said, most of our patients live on $600 a month or less.
Okay, this seems beyond corrupt. This is on the verge of evil. I
yes.
mean, how? Okay,
now now you know why I do what I do.
I really do, and you know, thank you for doing it. How is it? How is it that? You know, all of these, I mean, you know, social media and whatever, when this passed, everybody got really excited about the passing of the legalization of marijuana.
A lot of money spread around. They had $6.5 million to spend to get I-502 sold. And boy, they brought media.
But
they brought all the media.
But I mean, the thing was, I mean, it seems like this is a massive step backward for individual liberty and basic civil rights. And yet those on kind of our side, the liberty crowd, were cheering it. I mean, they didn't have to spend $6 million because their opponents were on side.
But they didn't hear the other side.
Why didn't they?
Well, because the other side spent $6.5 million and we were only able to, patients are poor. And we managed to raise $7,000.
Yeah, but hold on a second. This is a big issue.
$6.5 million.
This is a pretty big issue now. I mean, you know, as social issues go, you know, the very fact that the country was even interested in cannabis shows that it is a significant issue. And that part of the reason for that is that there are a bunch of people who use it. So, you know, surely there is a large community of cannabis users that could have been co-opted by, you know, the right side, by the likes of you and what you know. How is it that we weren't able to mobilize them and say, you're about to get screwed?
Well, there were a lot of people that did, but what they did was they spent $3 million on television time producing commercials to go after the soccer moms, and they sold it on the idea that it was going to get rid of the black market, that they could spend less money on law enforcement, that they're going to bring in. They predicted $582 million a year in state tax revenues. It was all a lie.
Now let's talk about exactly that, because
well, the other thing they said was that it was not going to affect medical marijuana, and you know, I was born at night; it just wasn't last night. And we saw it coming, and since then they have tried consistently, and they'll do it again this year, to try to get rid of medical, because they need to force all the medical patients into those retail stores so the state can get their tax money.
Right, so now let's talk about that, because if I understand correctly, Steve, legalization didn't kill the black market precisely because it's taxed to high heaven. Is that right?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you've ever had an economy 101 class, you know what causes a black market.
If you've ever had an economy 101 class,
taxation, illegality.
I was just going to say, Steve, if you've ever had an economy 101 class, then you're not a state legislator.
Well, you're also not an I-502 licensee.
Right. Enough said. Okay. So I interrupted. So carry on. Yeah. So what happened here?
Well, so I argued that was, of course, ridiculous, because they're taxing the way they've done it is unlike, it's much different than Colorado's. What they did here was they taxed it 25% to the producer, 25% to the processor, 25% excise tax to the retailer, and another 10% sales tax on top of that. You have to add to that a 39.8% federal tax, and they just bumped that another
10%. Hold on a second.
This last week.
There's a federal tax on marijuana. That means it's legalized at the federal level or decriminalized.
Well,
but it isn't,
no,
is it?
It doesn't, and there's a lawsuit going on about that right
so
now.
So hold on. Are you saying there's a federal law on the books that taxes marijuana?
It's your standard business tax.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay. The cost
Under federal tax, under the federal IRS code 280E, you cannot take any deductions. In other words, you cannot deduct the cost of goods sold, you cannot deduct your rent, you cannot deduct your employees, so you're paying the whole 40%. And what they did 2 weeks ago, are keeping all of these people from getting bank accounts. And so now, when you normally would write a paycheck and take out your FICA tax, it is paid automatically out of your bank account. Since you don't have a bank account, because they won't let you get a bank account, they are charging you another 10% on top of that.
Okay, so how
they were trying to say, they tried to argue, and people just wouldn't listen, I guess, or not enough people would listen, that they were going to be able to undersell the black market with all those taxes.
Which is obviously nonsense. So,
well, with anybody with half a brain, you can see where you can't have 25%, 25%, 25%, 10%, and 50%. And undersell me.
So now what has started, let's get some simple statistics here. Of the market for cannabis, medical and non-medical, what fraction of it is still completely black market?
80 to 90%.
Okay. So
10 to 20%, depending on who you ask, is medical, which means that even if they were to, and boy, they tried really hard. I fought them and won this last session, and we'll do it again this coming session. Even if they were to write laws that to try to force us to go and buy from those stores, take away our rights to grow, take away the amount we could possess, everything else, patients, we'll get into pricing here in a minute, but patients are not going to go to those stores. First of all, they don't have the products that patients would use. We use things like Rick Simpson oil, which is not available. High CBD medications, which we are using to treat children with epilepsy. They have almost no THC in them. It doesn't get them high, but it stops their seizures. Those kinds of things, if you're going to a recreational store, you want to get high. You want THC. You're not going there to cure your epilepsy. You're going there to get high. And so they A, won't have the products. B, they're going to be far exceed what any patient could ever afford.
What I
would do is they force the whole patient community into the black market.
Hold on, I'm a bit confused. Before this law passed, patient and non-patient was all black market. The law
patients were not black market.
Okay, so are you saying, so you're saying that they had legal access to legal marijuana with under much less prohibitive conditions than now exist?
The governor vetoed sections out of a bill that would have licensed and regulated medical dispensaries here in 2011. This was at the request of law enforcement. They didn't want us to be have official standing.
So as patients, you were all ready to possess beforehand, right?
Well, we're still allowed to grow and possess, and dispensaries opened. I opened one of the first ones. And in Seattle, there's over 250 dispensaries. There's one recreational store, and it's not open right now because it ran out of pot the first 3 days. But the difference being, if you go into a dispensary, and a lot of patients, don't get me wrong, a lot of patients can't afford to go into a dispensary. If they don't grow their own marijuana, they don't have medicine.
So before the law passed, 502, patients, medical users, could grow their own, but non-medical users could not, and now everybody can? Is that correct?
No. Nobody besides patients can grow. It didn't change that, but they tried to change that in the legislature last session.
Okay. Now
they tried to take away our rights to grow. They tried to cut the amount of medication we could possess by 83%. There were no doctors involved in making those decisions. That was the Department of Revenue, the Liquor Control Board, and an attorney from the Department of Health. But they weren't able, thanks to Liberty Republicans in the legislature, we were able to fight that off, and we'll fight it off again next year. But if you walked into a dispensary up here now, you can buy marijuana anywhere from $6 to maybe $11 a gram, average $9 or $10 a gram.
Okay, so $10
over
a gram from a
Spokane right now, it's about $35 a gram. So I can buy an ounce here for under $200 in a dispensary. If I go to one of these 502 stores, we've seen prices as high today as $980 for an ounce.
Okay, now I'm confused again.
Okay,
so you've just given me different prices for medical and non-medical, but now that
I gave you a gram price, which is about $8 or $9 a gram.
Right.
Okay, that works out to about $200 an ounce.
Right,
okay?
But then you said at dispensaries, you said some huge number.
Well, no, not dispensaries, at the Liquor Control Board licensed stores.
Right. Hold on a second. So you're talking to somebody who knows nothing about this. So you got to define the terms for me, right?
Okay.
A dispensary.
Well, the recreational stores, and there's only a handful of them.
Right.
The prices ranged when they opened. And again, when I say they opened for 2 or 3 days, and then they had to close down because they ran out of pot immediately because it's the system.
But if they may, if
run, they only had enough marijuana for a 2 or 3 day supply for half a dozen stores.
Right. Why isn't the market taking care of that? If they're shifting it so fast, people should be producing it like crazy.
I've been around this business for a long time. I would have been a good person if you would have picked somebody who knew about marijuana and growing marijuana. I would have been a good person to be an expert to help set this up. I didn't want the job. They hired a drug policy guy out of California Dr. Mark Kleiman, who knew nothing about it. The Liquor Control Board is the same people who screwed up a liquor monopoly. And so because they screwed up the liquor monopoly, the voters took it away from them. And so what happened was the initiative gave them recreational marijuana to mess with. And, of course, they know nothing about it.
Right.
So for the last 2 years, they've been just kind of thrashing around.
So now, these huge taxes, those taxes apply specifically and only to recreational marijuana. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, there's no tax on medical. And as long as I'm alive, there won't be. You don't tax any other medication. Why do I have to pay a tax when you don't pay any tax on your medication?
Okay, now, to be a medical user, presumably you have to get certification from the state, right?
Well, No, we have no state registry. You have to get a recommendation from a doctor.
Okay, so presumably...
What they want to do is they want to register us like sex offenders, but that's another thing. Over my dead body, they will get that.
So what fraction of people who don't need it medically have got a doctor to write them a recommendation?
What percentage of people that are using
recreational users are going to dispensaries with a letter from the doctor?
All of them. No, you can't get into a dispensary without a doctor's
recommendation. No. That's not my question. If I was a recreational user and I could get it a lot cheaper and kind of legitimately as a medical user, then I would try and get a doctor to certify that I'm a medical user. So there must be a large fraction of recreational users that are purporting to be medical users.
Oh, I'm sure that there are, and by the way, one of their arguments is that no one would sign up to be a medical marijuana patient anymore because the marijuana in these state stores is going to be so cheap that there's no reason to pay a doctor to get a recommendation. In fact, recommendations have gone through the roof.
Because it's so much cheaper if you are a medical user because of the taxes.
Well, if you could buy something at $200 an ounce, or you could buy it at $1,000 an ounce.
Right.
And especially if the $200 stuff is actually better.
Okay.
No one's going to pay five times as much for essentially the same product.
Absolutely. But I asked you a question earlier. What's the answer to my earlier question, which is if these recreational stores are kind of, you know, all of their marijuana was sold in 3 days. That says that even at that price, there's profit. The market should be taking care of it, and the production should be going up.
Well, okay. There were 2,720 applications for producer licenses. That's growers.
Yeah.
2,720 applications last December they started issuing licenses.
Okay.
And out of that 2,720, only 80 licenses have been issued. At this rate, the 2,720 applications, they'll go through those in 37 years. That's how inefficient they are.
Okay. But in theory, let's say, this is good news for those 80 because there's massive demand. And even with those taxes. Oh, hold on. We're going into the last break. Hold on a second. This is the last segment of Blue Republican Radio with me, Robin Kerner. So I'm going to be quick. I want to throw that question back to Steve. Steve, I asked you if the free market, well, not very free, but the market will kind of take care of this situation just because, you know, the marijuana that was available went off the shelves. There are 80 producers who have been licensed now. Doesn't that mean that this is going to normalize and we're going to get recreational marijuana for a more reasonable price soonish?
No, it doesn't. 80%, according to experts, 80% of the marijuana is consumed by 20% of the users. And those 20% of the users are not going to pay outrageous prices for the marijuana. So even having an increased supply when your taxes are at 125%,
mm-hmm.
And the cost of regulation is almost doubling that, the prices are not going to go down.
So are you saying that the fact that all that product moved in the first 3 days is not reflective at the same prices? It won't continue to move if it was made available at the same price?
Oh, no, because there were only two growers that even had any product available to feed all of the stores.
Right.
So they sold out in 2 days.
Right. So why won't somebody else sell out at the same price?
Well, because everybody that I went to the opening of the first store, everybody will go and buy 1 gram at that price,
right.
And where people were actually framing it and putting it on the walls as collectors.
Okay, so you're saying that there was another segment of demand that was driving that.
Well, yeah, it was, and they had it in Colorado too, but it hasn't kept up. Even though this situation is far worse than Colorado, you cannot tax something at 125%. Without the price going up 125% one way or another. And you add the cost of regulation to it, and it's probably gone up 200% at least. And at 200%, you cannot compete. This is a very price-sensitive product.
Yeah.
The Rand Corporation did a study, and they said the tipping point on marijuana. This was a study done about 4 years ago.
Be quick. We've got 10 seconds.
The tipping point is $50 an ounce.
$50 an ounce. Well, let's see if we get anything close to that in the white market in Washington State. It doesn't look like it. Thank you for joining me, Steve. I appreciate your time.